Shad Khan presents a new proposal for a riverfront hotel and convention center at the shipyards. Crowdfunding rescues a local teenager shunned by his parents for being gay so he can go to college. And questions after a police officer won't face charges for beating up another teenager. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are live this Friday for First Coast Connect. Just ahead, a busy week in the news with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can get on the line now as we talk about the biggest stories from the week. Join us at 549-2937. Then later, our own beloved late-night music show, The Electro Lounge, marking a milestone this week, 4,000 shows. We'll talk about it with host David Luckin. That's later in the hour, and here's some great music, too. That's ahead. But first, it's Friday and time to talk about a very busy news week as we welcome our Friday roundtable. WJCT contributor Fred Matthews is here. Hey, Fred.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you. Tim Gibbons, editor of the Jacksonville Business Journal.
Good to be here.
Claire Goforth, who edits Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
And WJCT's own Ryan Bank.
Good morning.
Guys, so good to have you. Lots to talk about this week. Everything from the story of a local teenager that's gone viral around the world after his parents kicked him out for being gay. We'll talk about that one. Also, there's been controversy after prosecutors dropped charges against a local police officer who had beaten up another teenager. And from algae to red tide, Florida is having a summer of yuck across the state. We'll look at that, too. All of that ahead. But first this morning, Jaguars owner Shad Khan is submitting plans for a downtown riverfront convention center and hotel. Khan's investment company, Iguana, is proposing this project along with a couple of other businesses. And they've submitted plans to the Downtown Investment Authority and released a series of renderings for us all to look at. Maybe you saw them this week. Now, the proposal includes a 490,000 square foot state-of-the-art public convention center and a 350-room hotel for that convention center with views of the river, a public riverwalk promenade, and more. Speaking to reporters from London on Thursday, Jaguars president Mark Lamping said the project's cost is estimated to be anywhere between $425 to $450 million, and it will be a public-private partnership. Here's Lamping.
We certainly will expect that this will be a partnership with the city, a project like this. And I think as you all have observed, major projects like this don't happen unless there is a partnership between the private investor and the public. So we expect the city to be a part of this, and I'm sure the city expects the same thing.
Now, this big proposal also includes a mixed-use project for Lot J. That's the parking lot just west of the football stadium. All of this, of course, is contingent on the removal of those big ramps that come off the Hart Bridge. Can that be accomplished? And what do you think of Shad Khan's latest move? Give us a call. 549-2937 as we discuss this shipyards proposal, 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at WJCT.org, tweets to at Melissa in Jax, or you can comment on our Facebook page. Tim Gibbons, our business editor, let's start with you. Khan splashed out with this right after three other companies had offered their own bids for a new downtown convention center just down Bay Street, just down from the football stadium at the site of the old county courthouse and city hall annex.
I think that's, in some ways, not the most interesting part of this necessarily. The project itself might be the most interesting, but the timing is fascinating. So the city went out several months ago with a request for proposals to explore the idea of a convention center where the old courthouse is. Obviously, that it's a decaying old husk. It will be demolished. That plan's already in the works. So the question was, what do we put there? That's long been seen as the site that could be a convention center. You have the Hyatt Riverfront right there. The entire thing just seemed to have some synergies. Those responses to the RFP were due Wednesday. Mm-hmm. On Thursday, this plan comes out. And it sets up an interesting dynamic of, does the city even bother going ahead with that RFP process? Because God knows, there's still an argument about if Jacksonville can support a convention center, it dang well doesn't need two.
Doesn't need two, exactly. But as you said, Tim, the most interesting part of this whole announcement from Khan is looking at the plans. What does everyone think of the plans? Fred Matthews.
Well, the plans are great. And forgive me, this is a bit of deja vu. Didn't we just discuss this last year?
Yes, we did.
Isn't the same thing on the table? The city's got to clear out the garbage underneath the ground at the shipyard.
There's contaminated soil. They got to take down the ramps, yeah.
And the ramps got to come down. The mayor's got money for it, and he's going to do it as soon as the election's over next year. And isn't Berkman 2 just been purchased by someone who's going to put a hotel and a, quote, entertainment center there? And Berkman 1 is still sitting there. And isn't the city hall was going to be torn down anyway? So the question is, why did the DIA go ahead with these requests for proposals, knowing that they basically have already given Khan the nod to do this? I think we're going to have a lawsuit somewhere that's going to hold this up yet again, because these guys who are going to put in their bids for it and spend money are going to be mad.
You mean grand visions that we're excited about will not actually come to pass?
They're going to happen.
Wait a minute. No.
Wait a minute.
Good grief. And then
I've never heard of such a thing.
And then there's Maxwell House across the street. Oh, and that great vision, the great view they'll all have of the jail.
This discussion, I mean, it is the discussion that the business community is having right now, of how do all of these pieces fit together? The jail is an interesting bit. Obviously, if you're going to have downtown truly blossom, you need to get rid of the jail.
No.
That would be stupid to do that.
Lock them up.
And let's just spitball the cost of that.
Zillions of dollars.
Yes, exactly.
But here's the thing. If you get the entire riverfront activated, if you actually have, you have to do something with the landing, but if you basically go all along Bay Street and have actual things there, then the public pressure and the money to do something with the jail becomes a reality. But it's steps. I mean, you got to take that first step to actually make something happen.
Claire, go for it.
And how are taxpayers going to feel when we're handing over tens and tens of millions of dollars to someone who's worth $7 billion, when we have people in Springfield who are in septic systems that were promised to be on city sewer in 1967, and we have neighborhoods that are blighted, we have curbs that are crumbling, we have infrastructural issues all over the city. It's not just downtown that the city needs to focus on spending its money. I think that a lot of us are of the mindset that downtown needs to improve its development. It does. But how much money should we as taxpayers be paying into that? I mean, the fact is, he's a businessman. He's here to make money, and he is going to make money, and that is going to come at the expense of some things that we may want.
And let me just throw out, as we talk about all this, at the same time, Mark Lamping, the Jaguars president, also confirmed that he's talking with the utility, JEA, about potentially relocating their headquarters over to this new development.
According to some reporters that have been covering this story for a while now as well, that rate payers are going to be on the hook for about $60 million, in addition to the $37 million in public spending that's being asked for to tear the heart ramp and do the study. I think on top of that, one thing that everybody kind of forgets is that we're here at the, to Claire's point, we're here at the anniversary year of consolidation, which was a promise by the city to certain neighborhoods to give them more access to funds to help repair things and to help pump investment into their communities. And here we are in this very anniversary year, looking at giving tens of millions of dollars to a businessman who could probably foot this bill himself.
And who doesn't even live here, let's be honest. I mean, you don't have to live here in order to develop things, but the fact is, I don't know of a piece of property that Shad Khan owns in Jacksonville.
I mean, this is a bit of muddled thinking from the leadership, the DIA. And, I hate to blame it on the mayor's office, but it's a bit of muddled thinking. It was no happenstance that the Khan's folk dropped their proposal back down again in the media spotlight a day or two after DIA made this announcement. They wanted to, this is a big boy announcement that, hey, we've already made this announcement. You've already approved us. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. And it's no accident that happened yesterday.
Showing some muscle.
It is. Do keep in mind that one of the three, the only local of the three respondents to the RFP was Rimrock Devlin, who is involved with Khan's project as well. We don't know We won't know for 28 days now what's in those proposals, but there's also a little bit of trying to keep a foot on both sides. I get the point that you're making, that this is somewhat trying to steal the thunder from the city's plan to move ahead with a convention center at the old courthouse site. But there's also the idea that it's not that like the city rapidly committed to that. This was seen as an exploratory sort of thing. And, you know, I'm not sure if it's wrong to put two things in the mix because it lets people have more decisions.
And I think another thing that's going to be make this a more interesting fight is that all three of the developers, including Conn and the other two that want to do this convention center, are actually donors to the mayor, to Mayor Lenny Curry. And I wonder how that's going to play out.
No,
and,
that doesn't have anything to do. I mean, just, no.
So a reporter at the Times Union, Nate Monroe, is the one who pointed this out on Twitter. And it is an interesting case. Case here because you have these three who are supporters and boosters of the mayor, and pitting them all three against each other, it seems like a strange issue.
I don't know. Where I grew up, there was a saying, the big dog eats first. I just observed that over the years.
Well, guess who the big dog is here?
Well, no, to Fred's point, there's also an interesting dynamic, though, where we have one local company and two Texas companies who responded to the RFP. There's an interesting dynamic of at what point does it become Shad Khan gets to do what he wants and other outside investors, mm-hmm. to Claire's point, always get shunned. We've seen that with the district where you had an outside company who bid on it and local developers got chosen. It can be a bad path for Jacksonville to go down to feel like it's only Shad Khan or people who live here who get to do projects.
Let's go to your calls now. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. What are your thoughts about Shad Khan's new renderings he's put out for his idea to develop the shipyards? New convention center, new hotel, a new entertainment district. We've already seen those. Give us a call, 549-2937. Dennis is at the beaches. Hey, Dennis, you're on the radio. Good morning.
Thank you. I've said it before. I'll say it again. As long as you're letting prisoners out of the jail at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning on the Bay Street, you can build all you want along that stretch. People aren't going to be interested in living there if they see that situation existing. Something's got to be done with the jail. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
You know, we talked about JEA possibly moving to that site. If the shipyards is interested in public infrastructure, maybe the jail should go there.
What?
But you know, but how is this caller wrong? He's not wrong.
He's not.
Well, but people have, when they get bailed out. I mean, that's not going to change. And we're at a point of realism. The jail's not going to be torn down and moved in our lifetime.
Wait, why not, though?
It's not. Don't have the money.
How do you know
that? I didn't say it wasn't going to be moved. I said it's not going to be moved anytime soon because of the cost of that. Look, one of the things we're wrestling with right now.
Look at what we paid for the Duval County Courthouse.
Well,
what was the final price tag? $350 million?
And those were the newest, the county courthouse and the federal courthouse are the newest constructions downtown has had since we built the old courthouse back in the 1950s.
But all I'm saying, Fred, is if the right people decide that it's imperative to move that jail, that jail's going to be moved.
That is an actual thing that you can. I mean,
that's my only point.
Voters voted to extend the sales tax in order to deal with the pension issue. We can discuss if that was actually the best way of dealing with that. But the fact that voters were able to get on board with that, and that was a really abstract thing, I'm pretty sure that someone could convince the populace to, you know, vote to pay to move the jail somewhere else.
In exchange for what?
Not having the jail downtown.
For who? The question still comes the same.
For the people
that
stand to make a lot of money from this planned development.
Exactly. And we're back to the same thing. There's no guarantee for the taxpayers who are going to agree to tear down the ramps, who are going to agree to move Maxwell House and the jail and possibly the sheriff's office. There's no guarantee that the taxpayers are going to benefit from this ideal except for the developer who is going to reap all of the funding and will own that section of effectively downtown.
And it's 549-2937. Lots of calls this Friday morning. Andy on the south side. Andy, good morning.
I have 3 points. I'll try to make them each very quick. Number one, I hear Fred talking about that the jail won't... he's tying his lifetime to it, that in his lifetime, wait a minute, Fred, I want you to live a long life, and I'm afraid that the jail may be replaced before you want to die.
We'll see. We'll see.
Please, God Almighty, don't tear down the Park Ridge ramps. That's just ridiculous. But the third item is that they rationalize every kind of ridiculous thing they want to do. And the argument always is because we're going to put more property on the tax roll. It'll expand our tax base. It'll expand our tax base. And frankly, you can justify doing anything you want for downtown if you're truly expanding our tax base. That was the theory way back in 1974 in the Mid-Island Conference. But the problem is, this is the anniversary of 50 years ago when people went to jail at that time because we didn't properly tax our properties. If we're going to fully tax everything that we put up in downtown, that'd be one thing. But we have under-assessed the rich folks here in Jacksonville. Right now, we could have enough money to just take care of the pension plan, enough money to take care of the new fire stations, enough money to pay the or more cops. We have more libraries. We have longer hours. And not even raise the millage. We could even lower the millage if we just put all properties on the tax roll at 100%.
All right. Thanks, Andy. Thank you. That former radio host, former state legislator Andy Johnson calling in. Thanks for that call.
I mean, Andy makes a very valid point about what the benefit is going to be to the taxpayers. I think they'll probably pitch it on jobs, as usual, and economic development. You know, when we have...
Well, and there is a legitimate case to be made. I mean,
that's true.
You know, there's a case to be made that a vibrant downtown district...
But how much should we pay for that? You know, I mean,
yeah,
that's
the question.
That's the question. But we've got the dredging as well. That is going to cost how many millions of dollars? That's coming due. And we have various other issues around the city. There are people who barely ever go downtown and will only see a benefit to this, sort of a secondary benefit. You know, where's the money going to come from? Are we going to A, raise the millage rate, or B, sell off some city assets?
5-4-4-9-2-9-3-7. We'll answer that question in a moment. Chad is downtown. Hi, Chad. You're on the air.
Good morning, Melissa, and a great show this morning with your media roundtable. One of the questions I have for the group is that it seems like every year we have these great big visions for downtown and other areas of the city, but they're always very short-term, very short-sighted. And when we're talking about the jail and developments of the north side, how we can have a better strategic plan of the next 3, 5, and 10 years rather than always fits and starts of every few years.
Okay, thanks for that question.
Part of that's just a function of politics and, you know, having mayors come and go and city council members come and go. Many cities, particularly those with term limits, have problems with that long-term planning sort of thing because you have to either move fast and get it done or, you know, it just kind of lingers and dies. Mm-hmm. You know, as we were kind of alluding to earlier, the plans here for the shipyards are not the first plans to come out for the shipyards. That is kind of like an annual event of new renderings. I think one of the frustrations even people who support these plans have is the idea that it has to move forward. Something has to actually happen. Renderings aren't enough.
Here's an email from Stephen. What will be the total cost of removing the Hart Bridge ramps and rerouting traffic once that's done? Because obviously for all of this to work, they're going to have to find the funding for that.
And aren't they asking for money from the federal government for the Hart Bridge ramp removal? I know they asked last year and were denied, and they're asking again this year.
I think the mayor's indicated what he has, 15 million.
He has 12.5.
Already.
But that's not, I mean, that's just a portion of it.
Well, right. But he's pretty certain that he's going to get the other half of it. It's just that we're not going to get that reveal until after the election next spring. We're not going to get that reveal, but he's pretty confident he's going to do it. And I don't see anybody realistically arguing against those ramps, that they're tearing down those ramps at this time.
The problem is there is no, you know, organization to support keeping the ramps. I think there's lots of people who don't necessarily want them to come down.
Jacks.
Right, exactly. Right. I mean, like, keep the ramps
keep
up.
Keep them up.
Right.
I
commute on those ramps. They're very convenient.
We have to take them down, Jacks. Jacks.
A lot of people find them convenient, but I mean, although, Claire, I mean, I could see you starting an activist group.
Keep them up, Jacks.
Right, you know how I do, Tim.
Yeah, I mean, it, for those who travel
Melissa has
that,
given you a slogan.
But realistically, for those who travel that heart bridge and have to make that decision whether they're going downtown or whether they're going to the north side, the ramps become important. And as the accident yesterday showed, when you get a jam up or an accident on there, it backs all the way back up across the heart bridge and you're stuck there. There's no getting away. There's no escape. You have to be there. So when if you're going to cut down 2 to 4 lanes of access coming across that bridge, anything happens, everybody's going to be stuck once again down to squeezing those 4 lanes down to 2, down to 1 to get onto the MLK expressway. But I mean, that's of no concern to the planners and the developers. By the way, Tim knows this, and I guess the question is, all of this is going to be funded partly by bonds, which are going to be, we're all going to be beholden to for how many years?
30.
Okay. That's how it's going to be funded. So all of this, and there's going to be a tax break given to the developer. We always give them a tax break, at least 5 to 10 years, where they don't pay taxes on what they're doing down there. Ask Mr. Rummel. I mean, they're not going to pay any taxes on this for several years, and we're going to float the bond to do all of this stuff. So the taxpayers need to be aware of this. And if you don't care, I mean, again, 30 years down the road, who's going to know? Who's going to care? And that's the point about this. Nobody's going to care because you're not going to have to float the bill, but it's going to be there.
But in some ways, and I think that this conversation is part of a larger conversation the city kind of sort of has, and I don't know any way to have it, you know, more openly, but what do we want to be as a city? And a lot of that question is, if the taxpayers are paying for it, it's because the idea is the taxpayers in some either monetary or just general sense are benefiting by having a vibrant downtown.
So here's the thing about that, and I'm glad you bring that up because I wanted to circle back to this and I didn't want to change the subject here since Fred was on a roll. But
Fred is always on a roll.
Always. So what I want to say, though, is that we can talk all day about whether or not it's going to, you know, tangentially benefit taxpayers in the rest of the city. But let's be honest about what the kind of development is going in there. It is a for-profit development. Most people cannot afford in this city to go out many times a month, if at all, to any of these projects that are being tossed around at the shipyards, right now at the stadium, to have Jags tickets. All of that is a luxury. And those are luxuries that people are paying for already, but then won't have access to because they don't have the capital to spend on it.
Hold on.
So what you have now is the classic thing where somebody who has the money, right, to pay for all these projects themselves is not only getting tax subsidies and tax breaks, you know, to build these projects. And you could talk about the need for a vibrant downtown, and that much is true. Everybody can agree on that. But the issue here is people are almost getting billed twice because they're getting the tax breaks that are going to these developers. They're not going to see that money. They're not going to see the fruits of that money. And then if they want to go and visit these places, if they have some expendable income at some point in time, they're going to have to pay again. So it really is kind of like a double tax on most of the city that will not have access to this.
Speaking of paying, at one point they were talking
about putting in the Four Seasons. Who can go to the Four Seasons?
We have to move on and talk about another story that made headlines this week.
We're working at the Four Seasons.
All right. It's 549-2937. Speaking of paying, a lot of people have been paying whatever they can afford to help a local honor student raise tuition money to go to Georgetown University this fall. This is a story that has gone global. Now, it all started out when First Coast High School graduate Seth Owen, who is gay, was told by his strict Baptist parents that he had to undergo gay conversion therapy, which has been widely debunked, and also attend their church. Their ultimatum was he had to do that or leave their home. Seth says, given the church's views on homosexuality, he had no choice but to leave. So he did. The problem was Georgetown. He had been accepted. He's the co-valedictorian of his high school class. But Seth says his family refused to sign his financial paperwork for his scholarship to Georgetown. That's actually something his father denies. But here's what happened next. Seth's biology teacher, Jane Martin, set up a GoFundMe account telling
Seth's story and asking for donations to help him attend Georgetown. It quickly went viral with reports around the country. And as of this morning, the GoFundMe for Seth Owen has raised more than $127,000. And he will need every penny of that because tuition at Georgetown can be as high as, I think, $70,000 per year. Claire Goforth broke this story, which has since gone around the world. Claire, how did this all come to you?
So a gentleman by the name of Jeff Piercy knew some of the teachers from Seth's school, heard the story. He used to work for Folio Weekly. He reached out to us and immediately, you know, we were interested in the story. I went and met with Seth in late June with two of his coaches. And at that time, he was working at Publix. He was tentatively optimistic, but there was a lot of doubt in this young man that he was actually going to be able to fulfill his life's dream and go to Georgetown. After I spoke with him and heard about the conversion therapy and the really strict beliefs at this church, which he did not want to go to, he told his parents he would go to any church but that one, and that they kicked him out that night on the grounds that a child listens to their parents. And if the parent says, "You're doing this," then you're doing it, or else. Then he bounced around for a while, couch surfed. The teacher started a GoFundMe. And the next thing you know, we broke the story. First Coast News had a story as well. I believe they were reporting concurrently on their own. And this is just an amazing success story. I mean, I am so happy for Seth. And that, you know, this just goes to show what the crowd can do and also what a caring teacher can do in the life of a young man. But, you know, to the point on young homosexual and trans people who, I mean, these stories are all over the country. They're in our community as well. They mm-hmm. get kicked out because of these very things. And Seth is one of the lucky ones. That's a sad fact. Although he has been through a lot, and you know, I think that today it's an amazing success story, and we all feel very proud about that. But just turn around and look around your community at the other kids who don't have it so good.
There's even a movie about this dynamic coming out this fall. It's called Boy Erased, and it stars Russell Crowe and Nicole Kidman as parents who enroll their son in a gay conversion therapy program.
Yeah, you won't even recognize Russell Crowe in that role.
And give us a call, 549-2937, as we talk about this. Here's a comment on our Facebook page from Rhoda. "I'm glad society recognizes conversion therapy for what it is. It should be banned in Florida."
Well, I mean, this is a classic, the classic case, and it's unfortunate that here we are in 2018, that of parents and children and parents continuing to follow the rigid line that they were raised with, and it's got to be this way, and children doing what children do, and that is they follow their own path. And as anybody knows, once they hit 13, 14, 15, 16, you're going to have to stand back a minute and see who they are, because these aren't the same little kids you had at 5 and 6. And, you know, as a parent who's raised children and watched them go through this cycle and find their own path, it's difficult. But you have to allow them, if you love your children, you have to allow them to grow and be who they are. And the church is a church. It's always going to be the church. But the church has evolved, just like the Pope, if I'm not, it just changed an edict on capital punishment. What's going to happen when the next Pope comes in line? Is he going to change it back? But people are there, and we have to allow that. And that's what America should be all about.
Nearly 1 million LGBTQ adults have undergone conversion therapy at some point in their lives, according to a study that came out earlier this year out of UCLA. Some countries have banned gay conversion therapy. The British government is one that is closest to our system of government. Some cities in America have put forth motions to ban this therapy. A majority of Americans believe that this therapy is harmful and ineffective. A long list of health associations have spoken out against it, including the American Medical Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics. And so you see from the GoFundMe, Ryan, Americans from all over and even people from overseas are rushing to this young man's aid?
I think something here that often it gets discussed in certain circles and gets reported on, but sometimes it doesn't kind of bubble up to the actual mainline public discussion about religion in this country. But there is a huge effort, especially on the part of the Catholic Church, to try to bring back, quote, you know, wayward souls. The flock is fleeing right now. Kids, Seth's age and younger, and even people of the millennial generation like mine, and older and younger on that spectrum, are finding out that the church doesn't always practice the values that they preach when it comes to acceptance and love. And because of that, you look at any study on this subject, you look at Pew, you look at Gallup, the fastest growing denomination, religious denomination right now in this country are nuns, basically. They're called no religion whatsoever. And I think a lot of it doesn't necessarily have to do with the major tenets of the religion. I think a lot of these people, like Seth, would like to what Claire reported, would be happy to go to church and to have that type of community. It's the rigidity, to what Fred said, of some of the kind of, quote, Levitical laws that keeps them from going back. And I know I've spoken to a lot of people that feel that way. And this was part of the discussion, kind of in an indirect way, when we were debating in this city, the HRO. And to that point, to Fred's point again about banning conversion therapy, there have been states that have done it in some municipalities and some counties. But the fact is, in Florida, we still haven't been able to pass statewide protections for LGBT people. So going a step further and banning something like conversion therapy is probably going to be a no-go, especially in a city like Jacksonville, where I would assume much of that does take place.
I know. I'm just looking this up. 13 states and the District of Columbia protect youth under age 18 from conversion therapy by preventing licensed mental health service professionals from conducting it. Almost 20 other states are considering similar laws. This UCLA report found 6,000 additional kids would have been subjected to this had it not been banned by their states.
Well,
that's where the states are on this.
I found it interesting, Ryan, because I actually saw, I kind of hit that same point in that story of the, he's sitting in church and it's the particular thing about child abuse that has him, you know, say, okay, that's it, I'll go to church, just not here. I mean, let's not wade into theological waters, but it's not a core tenet of really any church that, you know, child abuse is okay. So the idea that that's his issue, not with the church, not with religion, but with a rigid structure, you end up driving people totally away from church. Second point that I find with conversion therapy, as well as basically being mental abuse, is the oddity of it, of the, you know, the examples of fixing an old car or watching straight pornography. I, because of my sense of humor, find interesting that you would go from praying away the gay to, oh yeah, and go watch porn. That seems like weird. I never had a pastor tell me to watch porn.
Just on the
record.
You went to the wrong church, Tim. But, you know, to Tim's point as well, two things come to mind. One, I mean, religion believing that homosexuality is sinful, and two, believing that homosexuality is a choice, that this is some choice that people make to love who they love, to be attracted to who they are attracted to. I think that the majority of Americans would disagree with that, but there's a very strong minority that believes vehemently that homosexuality is a choice and it is a sin, and they will continue and continue and continue until hopefully maybe some minds start changing, or I guess the next generation comes up.
Well, the
majority of minds have changed.
They have, but there's a lot of people.
Marriage equality is the law of the land in all 50 states now. So this is a minority of Americans. But as you've said, Claire, it is a determined one, and it is one that is motivated by religious belief. So.
Well, I think we also have to kind of remember the line that some people, some activists that have been in the trenches for many years now, whether it is on the politics of sexuality or race or what have you, things that look like are settled public opinion aren't always settled public opinion. A plurality isn't the same as a vast majority. And the fact remains that we have seen a lot of these public polls backslide in recent years, especially in the last couple of years. But if you look at something, if it was a really interesting article and readout of some research some months ago about the abortion movement or the anti-abortion movement or the pro-life movement and how successful they have been since Roe v. Wade in overturning or further limiting abortion in certain states. They've also been successful on the PR end. Right now, you can flip a coin to see what side the country's public opinion actually sides on when it comes to support for abortion choice. And the same thing can happen in other instances. Just because it looks settled, just because a court rules on something, doesn't mean that you aren't going to have this fight later on. What we're finding now, we have found since the striking down of the Fence of Marriage Act, is state by state, you have states that are passing, quote, religious freedom laws. Now, there has been a big backlash in some of those states, and they've lost a certain amount of economic activity and lost face with some of their trading partners around the world and inside the country. But at the same time, this is something that they can still be successful. This is not a settled opinion right now in the country. And Seth Owens' story is a microcosm.
And look at our own clerk, our own courthouse. You can't get married in our courthouse because directly right when marriage equality began, they stopped having courthouse marriages as a response to that. And you look how people celebrated when the cake baker won their case just a few months ago. And, you know, the Supreme Court ruled that they cannot be forced to make a cake for a couple who are gay to celebrate their engagement or marriage on the grounds of religious freedom. People were thrilled.
That was a very narrow ruling too, though. It was mainly the court had found opposition to the Human Rights Commission in that state for the way that they treated the bakers. They didn't actually rule on the question at hand, which is
we need to move on. Also making news this week, a controversial case involving another local teenager and the police. Officer Timothy James will avoid jail and he can continue working as a police officer after an agreement with prosecutors. They've dropped charges against James after an incident where he beat 17-year-old Elias Campos, who was handcuffed at the time. Now, Officer James had a lengthy record of internal affairs complaints about excessive use of force, but the state attorney's office says there was a strong chance a jury wouldn't convict him. This outraged the attorney for the teenager, John Phillips, who appeared on this program yesterday. He said it was a miscarriage of justice. However, the police union says that the system worked as intended. Give us a call quickly, 549-2937, pardon me. One of those talking things today. Okay, so here again, we have some parts of the community up in arms over what they see as preferential treatment to a police officer who, when you look at the evidence here, was up against credible charges of misdemeanor assault, I think was the charge, right?
Yeah, that sounds right. But I mean, honestly, not delving into cynicism, but the idea of saying that a jury in Jacksonville would not convict a police officer on these charges,
That's not unrealistic.
That does not seem unrealistic. And the state attorney saying, let's not put our resources into this. Let's find another way to deal with the
and
situation.
And what do you all think of John Phillips saying, so what if you're not going to win the case? Do what is right.
That's a big question. Bring it? You know, because if you prosecute enough of these situations, eventually maybe you just get more traction. Maybe you do start changing public opinion.
And what does this say to other officers who are on the job? You know, I mean, he was reported by his own officers
and
four times in 3 years. Yeah. And what, there were 11 complaints against him in that time? I mean, just a few bad apples. Sure. I mean, this gentleman sounds as though he should not have been on the force.
Well, I mean, let's not be too flip about the police in that sense. I mean, the majority of police officers in this community are working to protect and serve the community.
I think that they are probably, I'm not sure, but officers are angry.
Reported this man. It was another officer. So, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, the reality is, if he had gone to jail, I don't know what the prison situation would have been like for a former police officer. I mean, and that is a question we should ask about what goes on in our jails. I mean, it is not any sort of human rights compliance. The people are being brutalized in jail, and that is likely what would have happened to him.
Well, oftentimes they're in protective custody, though. If there is a police officer that, especially if they have a record like this and they're convicted for something like that, usually they're they're kept away from the rest of the population, I think, for
Let's
good
go
reason
to
that you describe.
A couple of calls. Linda in Deerwood. Linda, go ahead quickly. You're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to see, this is another example, the prosecution decided not to move forward because they couldn't win it. I think their job is to bring a case and let the citizens decide. It's not their job to preemptive because they don't want to ruin their record. I don't want this to be thought that a police officer can just beat a teenager up. And it's like, okay, well, we won't prosecute it because we can't win it. Step up your game and do your job. Thanks,
Linda. Michael, let's get him on hold. Citizen. Michael in Jacksonville. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, that was kind of a surprise. I was just talking to your.
I know. We've only got a few minutes left. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, that's going to be difficult, then. I was just calling to share my opinion. I find it interesting and validation that there is preferential treatment. There is that blue line. The corrupt criminal justice system does protect their own, and as proof of that, I'm a 45-year-old male, been arrested twice in my life here in Jacksonville. Prior to that, I'm prior to law enforcement, 20-year fraud investigator, and I was arrested for holding a sign standing on a public road and for cussing out a bailiff. For those two arrests, which were false because the cops knew me, my activism, they had issues with me, I was paraded through a kangaroo court. I have over $90,000 in legal bills. I spent 6 months incarceration, 4 months house arrest, multiple $1,000s in fees and fines. And I find it incredible, I find it egregious that this criminal thug that wore a gun and a badge gets the special treatment that he gets, and a citizen that fought for this country gets the treatment I get because I fight against the system.
Michael, thanks for sharing your thoughts.
I think a lot of people feel that there's one type of justice for civilians and another type for police officers.
Well, many people are still surprised that politics would play this big a role in the prosecution, but it does. Remember the Freddie Gray Craig case up in Baltimore? That prosecutor carried that case all the way to the end. And what happened? Nothing. The police all went back to their jobs. Freddie Gray is still just as dead, and nothing came of it. And I'm sure that this was part of the calculus that went into this in every prosecutor's mind. And they want to win. It is about winning, folks. It ain't about justice. It never really is.
And we are almost out of time. It's been a very good discussion and a very serious one, but we always try to send you off with at least a little bit of a smile. So finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And this is a local one, you guys. Only in Florida do Westsiders make beer runs while carrying a live gator.
Oh, yeah.
Did you see this?
That was the best story.
This happened at a store on 103rd Street on the west side. The best side! Now, in the video, you see this gator-wielding man yell, "Y'all ain't out of beer, are ya?" Is he taking the last bit of your beer? Then he runs toward a customer with the gator, which had its jaws taped shut, and he grabs a 12-pack. The guy says it was all fun and games. However, he is now under arrest for animal cruelty.
Cops said, "See you later, alligator."
Sounds like he needed some Gatorade and some time to sleep it off.
He wouldn't have gotten charged with cruelty if he left
like
the tape off of the gator's mouth.
You know, I think he would have gotten charged with much
worse. That's the only reason they're charging him, because the gator's mouth was taped shut. Otherwise, he wouldn't be in any problems.
You can see the video online. You can read the work of Tim Gibbons, Claire Goforth, Ryan Bank, and Fred Matthews at their respective outlets. The West Side is the best side.
Well,
we'll be right back.
No comment.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Malignant mesothelioma. Asbestos dust causes this cancer. Learn more from board-certified civil trial specialist Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
Clay Today reaches the heart of Clay County. Clay Today print and digital products promotes businesses while providing local news and current happenings in Clay County. Information at claytodayonline.com.
Why is the sun's corona hotter than its surface? Well, after years of speculating, NASA is sending a spacecraft straight to the source to find out. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at what a new solar probe might discover as it gets up close and personal with the sun. Plus, can bacteria go extinct? It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
You know why God made snakes before he made lawyers? He needed the practice.
Better Call Saul begins season 4 on AMC Monday. On the next Fresh Air, we feature interviews with Bob Odenkirk, who plays Saul, Giancarlo Esposito, who plays drug kingpin Gus Fring, Peter Gould, the show's co-creator, and Jonathan Banks, who plays Mike. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
At Earth's equator, the Earth spins at about 1,000 miles per hour. And there are weeks when there's so much going on in the world, it can begin to feel that fast. We can't stop the world, but we do make time to look beyond our shores to find out more about the stories developing overseas. Join us for the global edition of the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it was on a Saturday night, way back in 2003.
Oh, no.
15 years ago, when a brand new music show first took to the airwaves here at 89.9.
It's 10 o'clock. It's Saturday night. It's a new year. It's 2004, and this is our first program of the new year. Mo Horizons is up first. Shake It Loose. You're listening to Night Flight on WJCT in Jacksonville, Florida.
Actually, it was 2004, but what a night it was. And since that first episode, David Luckin's Electro Lounge, first called Night Flight, has become a mainstay on our after-hours block of music programs here at the station. Overseeing all those shows is our own station manager, David Luckin, but through it all, he has kept his chill-out music going each night at 9 for, gosh, 15 years now.
Actually, 14. I did the math
wrong. Thrilling loyal listeners with his eclectic blend of sound. We are so excited to mark the 4,000th show of the Electro Lounge this week as we welcome David Luckin into the studio. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
It's tonight.
Tonight at 9. We're going to do an extra hour or two. We're going to take String Theory's spot for the extra hour. So from 9 to 12, we're going to play some of our favorite music, and I'll actually talk a little more than I usually do just to lead you through where we've been and where we're going.
Did you ever think it would build this kind of legacy when you did that first show?
I did not. It was just a little hour Saturday nights at 10 for the first 2 years. And then we, thanks to Tony Allegretti, he found us some funding and we pulled it full time in 2004, near the end of the four. So for some reason, I've been thinking 15 years, but if you do the math, it's 14. But I was never good in math, Melissa.
That's
good
okay.
in music.
That's all right. Yes, you are good in music. And so through the years, Electro Lounge has built this amazing fan base, not just here in town, by the way. People listen online from all over the world to this show because you put together playlists like nobody else, that just such an eclectic blend of music.
And basically what makes it like no one else is, and there are other people doing it, but we basically focus in on chill out, down tempo, new jazz, some reggae and dub, the music that's not played that often on your main station. So we try to carve out that little niche of giving people a little island of peace after a crazy work week, work day, that you can just kind of chill out. And then we throw in the surprises, things like Johnny Cash and James Brown and Pink Floyd's, because we want to remind us where we've been as we launch into where we are and into the future. So 80% of the music is fresh and about 20% is classic or jazz or something. But I just want to say, Melissa, the program is still fresh. It's just the host that has aged a little.
You're ageless. Come
there
on.
There you go.
And, you know, it's amazing to me to see how people will literally send you CDs and MP3s from around the world. You get stuff coming into this building all the time and that you turn around and play on the air.
And not only do they share their music, they share their voices. They've cut a lot of great IDs for me. Some of the best IDs we have for the program come from Switzerland and Germany and in England and all over. The musicians are really been very nice with sharing their music and us playing their great music, which makes it a great show.
Okay, so what are we going to hear on tonight's episode, the 4,000th, that's hard to say, the 4,000th show?
We're going to hear all my favorite songs. So we're going to hear people like the Thievery Corporation and JoJo Effect and Afterlife and Michael Franti and Spearhead and Nicola Conti, some Miles Davis. Of course, we're going to play Bob Marley and Elvis and the Beatles because we like to remember where we've been. But it's going to be a lot of fresh, a lot of upbeat, happy music for a down-tempo show. That's something, huh? We're gonna crank it up a little, but we're going to play some of our favorites. And I would be remiss, Melissa, if I didn't say thank you to all the local musicians from the Willow Wax and Monica and Chad and Canary and Nicole Mine and Rebecca Zapin and all the local folks who've come in here and made it a local program. And that's really important to me that we keep bringing in local musicians to give them a spotlight and to share their music with our community.
Sure. And of course, Electro Lounge on at 9 most nights of the week. Just one of our after-hours block of music shows that are just amazing and have great local hosts who are doing very cool things on our airwaves. But tune in for the special episode tonight, and we've got a bit of a preview as we close out this Friday. What are we going to listen to now, David?
I thought a lot last night in driving in. What should I play? Should I play my favorite jazz or Michael Franti's Stay Human is the most popular song I've ever played on the air. And then I thought, no, let's surprise people. Let's give them a Friday show or a Friday song that'll get them going. We're going to play James Brown. Papa's Got a Brand New Bag tonight. And Fred Matthews knew this, but usually it's part one and part two on
this
each
is
side
not part one
of
or two.
A 45. The version we're going to play tonight is part one, part two, part three, 7 minutes of James Brown egging the band on. We probably won't get to all 7 minutes, but it's a great way to end the show and to start your weekend. And to remind you to join us tonight. We're going to play a lot of great music for 3 hours starting at 9.
Well, kudos, my friend.
Thank
what a
you.
Run and many more to come. Thank you. And where else are you going to hear this?
Uh-oh, here it is.
This is James Brown. Papa's Got a Brand New Bag as we send you off into the weekend, everybody. Have a great one.
A lot of words, yeah, man.
Here he comes.
That was good, though. Yeah, it's a thing. Very good. Preaching, man. This is a hit! Come in the dust. Papa's in the sink. You ain't too hip. What that new breed thing. You ain't no drag.
Cats in their dancing.
Papa's got a brand new bag.
One A's up next. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Enjoy the music. Have a great weekend.
It's a jack. He's doing the fly. Don't play him cheap, cause you know he ain't shy. He's doing the monkey. The mashed potatoes. Jump back, jack. See you later, alligator. Come here, sister. Papa's in the swing.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.